Welcome to Shoot Like a Girl, a podcast featuring interviews with extraordinary military women from around the world who push their limits on and off duty. I'm your host, Kate Stewart, and this is episode number 34. Today's guest is Lieutenant Colonel Marissa Cherichella. Marissa knew she wanted to attend the United States Military Academy since she was 10 years old. She went on to serve as a military police officer and as a human intelligence officer in the United States Army Special Operations Command. She was also the first woman to serve as the executive officer for the Golden Knights, the U.S. Army parachute team. She speaks Spanish, French, and some Urdu. She has also done overseas assignments to Iraq and Syria and is currently serving as the Deputy Chief of Staff with the 82nd Airborne.
Daddy, night, man, daddy, light, help, cover. I'm a steamroller, baby.
I'm a steamroller, baby.
Just a rolling down the line.
Just a rolling down the line.
I'm a steamroller, baby.
I'm a steamroller, baby.
Just a rolling down the line.
Just a rolling down the line.
So you better get out of my way now.
So you better get out of my way now.
Before I roll all over you.
Before I roll all over you.
Okay, Marissa, welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you here. Ever since I heard you on the Solid 7 podcast, I was like, I need to poach her as a guest and get her on this podcast.
Yes, I'm excited that you reached out and that Kale shared your podcast with me. Thank you for inviting me to participate.
So I always like to start from the beginning. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. My dad is former fire department of New York City. My mom was a school teacher in New York City. I have a really interesting background, and you probably heard it on the Solid 7 podcast, but I love starting from the beginning. My mom and dad were told that they couldn't have children, so they decided to adopt. And in the early 80s, you could put out a classified ad in the newspaper. And that's exactly what they did. So they put out a classified ad in the newspaper, and it went throughout the United States in search of a child for adoption. And my mom had to set up a phone line through obviously lawyers. And one night there was a ring on that phone line and my mom answered it. And there was a woman from Wisconsin who had said, "Hey, I'm pregnant and I have an 18-month-old and I can't take care of two kids. I am interested in giving up this baby for adoption." And, you know, my mom was like, "Of course, we'll totally take the child. Here's our lawyer's information." And next thing you know, a few months later, my parents were, you know, taking me home from the hospital. And then a month after that, my mom was pregnant with my brother. And a year after that, she was pregnant with my youngest brother. So I grew up in an Italian family in New York City, and I had a very warm childhood. We had a wonderful upbringing. And then when I was 10 years old, we moved out of the city to our country home in Pennsylvania, which sort of changed the trajectory of my life. And we'll get into it, but that's where I took a field trip to West Point, and that's where I learned about the United States Military Academy and really sort of fostered this love of service and what I wanted to do in the future.
So just taking a step back, talking about the adoption, because I'm also adopted, so I'm super fascinated with this part of your story. How old were you when they told you you were adopted?
I did not know that about you. That is so cool. I always knew. My parents always told me, it was almost like a bedtime story. So my mom, when I would be going to sleep at night, would roll it up as like this bedtime story. And as I was getting older, I would ask her questions and I would say, "Are you talking about me?" And she would say, "Yeah, of course I'm talking about you." She would say things like, "There was this woman who lived in Wisconsin and she couldn't take care of a baby and she decided to give her to us. And now that baby is you and she lives with us." And I'd be like, "Oh my gosh, that's me." And as I got older and older, I would ask these questions and my mom would share more and more. And it just became commonplace for, you know, my parents to share what that was like. And when I was a senior in college at West Point, my mom had hired a locating agency to try and find my biological mother because we didn't know much. But we knew that she was from Wisconsin, but my biological mother had shared that, you know, it was a one night stand and she didn't know my biological father. And it wasn't until I had done 23andMe. And I don't know if you've done that yet, but that is how I found my paternal side of the family. And if you listen to the Solid 7 podcast, that is the connection to how I met Kale's family. And it's so interesting to have that connection. And you bringing it back to the military, just, you know, on the paternal side, biological paternal side, I have a military connection that I didn't even know existed. So maybe genetically there's some, you know, military connection. And I'd be interested, you know, once you do run down your genetic connection, if you have military lineage as well.
It's super interesting. And when I was listening to that episode, I was like, oh my goodness, the connection there was crazy. I didn't realize it was going to take that turn. I guess for me, it was similar in a way. When I was growing up, I don't ever remember my parents telling me I was adopted because I think they told me from such a young age. So it was just sort of like this normal thing when I was growing up, a very similar situation. So my biological mother had two kids already from a previous marriage and then sort of had me. They sort of had a relationship, but then he didn't really want to have anything to do with it. So she was a single mother at the time, couldn't take care of me. So I remember when I was little, just being like, I was adopted. Like, this lady had too many kids. I think at the time, you know, I was like, she had like five kids and couldn't take care of me. But it was never, there was never any sort of negative feelings of anything. It was just because since I knew from such a young age, it was just such a normal thing. And I haven't done 23andMe, but I feel like after this, I'm going to hop online and order a kit.
You absolutely have to. It was really cool to see that. I do think that having a child really changed that lack of knowledge for me, because I remember being pregnant and getting asked all those questions of, well, what runs in your family? And not having those answers really made me uncomfortable because I had no answer. I had to say no. And every time they'd ask me, I would say, I have no idea. And they would look at me dumbfounded. And I would say, I really have no idea. I was adopted at birth. And I was so frustrated by that. It wasn't that I was frustrated at the situation. I wasn't frustrated at my biological mother for putting me up for adoption. I wasn't frustrated at my adopted parents. I was just frustrated that there was no, you know, none of that information was passed on. I was frustrated at the situation that no one had shared that. And 23andMe does a really good job of handing over that information. And it's really cool to see that you can see some of those indicators in the system once you do it. And now that I have that connection and meeting some of my paternal family, and now I have people that I can see some of the similarities standing next to my cousin, and we have very similar facial features. And then giving birth to my son and being able to say, this is the first blood relative that I have in my family. It's remarkable to have that. So highly recommend for you. And thank you for sharing that you were adopted too. That's really neat.
So you grew up, I guess you were raised in an Italian-American family. So do you have any Italian-American background that you found out through 23andMe?
I do. I'm not majority Italian, though, even though my family will continue to claim that I am. So I will always claim Italian. I am majority British and Irish, which was very surprising to me because, as you can see me sitting across from you right now, for those that are listening, I have very dark features. I have dark hair and dark eyes, but I'm light complected and I blush very easily and I have curly hair. So to see that I was Irish was very interesting, but I'm about 15% Italian. So I do have some Italian in there. It was very interesting to see that. I was surprised by the results of it. But I like the fact that technology has really allowed the ability for me to be able to see what my genetic makeup is.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And even like you were saying before, like they put an ad in the paper. I mean, these days it's unheard of. I mean, kids these days probably wouldn't understand putting an ad in the classified section of the paper.
Right. Or that there was a house phone. I think there was like a TikTok video that I saw. Mind you, I saw the TikTok video on Instagram. I don't have TikTok, but the TikTok video was of a teenager talking about what a concept it would be to have a phone line dedicated in your house. And it was regarding, you know, what if there's an emergency and you lose cell service? And it was basically talking about a house phone. So the fact that we used to have house phones and that's the phone line that was set up for someone to call to talk about an adoption was how they did it back in the early 80s. So yes.
Yes. All this stuff to make me feel a little bit old now. So going back to growing up, what sort of activities or sports were you involved in?
So we moved from New York to Pennsylvania, and I took that field trip to West Point. And like I said earlier, it changed the trajectory of what I wanted to do. And I came home and I didn't have anyone that was in the military. I had no one in my family that had served. My grandfather on my father's side had been drafted to serve in Korea for a few years. But other than that, no connection whatsoever. I was the only girl. I had two younger brothers. And I came home from that field trip and I told my parents, hey, I want to go to West Point. They thought I would grow out of it. They thought that it was just, you know, a few fleeting moments and that would be it. But I was convinced this was for me. And they thought it was simply because I liked the way that the cadets looked in uniform marching around on the parade field. But no, it was the fact that I wanted to serve and I really enjoyed the idea of giving back. The other thing that really appealed to me is that my parents took a chance on a child that they had no idea what I would be like. And they gave me so many opportunities. And I really wanted to make sure that they didn't have to pay for my college. They didn't have to really make any more sacrifices for me. I wanted to be able to give back to them. And this was another opportunity for me to do that. I didn't want to have to give another burden to them. So this was another way for me to do that because West Point, you know, you get a full scholarship. There's no, you're going to the academy for 4 years and the Army is providing that education. So I was heavily involved in extracurricular activities. I played sports. I had really good grades. And I knew my freshman year of high school, I walked into my guidance counselor's office and I sat him down and I said, I need you to make my schedule so that I'm going to get into West Point. I need all the AP classes. I need all the extracurricular activities that are going to make me successful. And he looked at me dead in the face and he said, are you serious? And I remember him saying, but you're a woman. And I said, and what's wrong with that? And mind you, this was the 90s, but I said, I'm going and I need you to make it happen. And he said, okay, well, let's do this. So we did everything in our power to make it happen. I was a drum major. I played the saxophone. I played on the golf team. I ran track. On the weekends, in the wintertime, I did skiing. I was a ski instructor. I was really busy. I'll put it that way. I enjoyed spending time with my family. I enjoyed spending time with my friends. We lived in a seasonal community. So in the summertime, we were out on the lake, water skiing, tubing, doing things outdoors, or I was studying, doing things like that. So very busy. And I'm sure my parents, now that I'm a parent, I don't know how they kept three kids at every single event, but they did it and they were at everything. So yeah, I was heavily involved in a lot of different things.
That when you were describing sort of the thought process of how your parents took a chance on you and you didn't want to be a burden, that seems to me at such a young age, that's such a very mature thought process for that, I guess, like, you know, that the fact that someone so young would be thinking that. And then also, I guess, as you're growing up, did you ever change your mind about that or think like, maybe I'll do something else? Or was it just laser focused on West Point the whole time?
I think there were times where I thought about doing other things, but they were very leadership heavy. So there were other items of focus. I was either going to be heavily involved in government. So I was interested in going to Washington, D.C. So I was looking at political science majors, going to George Washington University or going to Georgetown and getting into some sort of political science realm. Or I was interested in working in some form of the government. I was also looking at schools that had ROTC programs because I, again, wanted to serve in some capacity and I wanted to find a way to either work for the government or serve in the military. And I wanted to have a way to not have my parents pay for my college. So my parents always had this aspect of, we'll pay for some of it, but I wanted to be able to provide an opportunity for my parents to not have to pay for it. And the Army, for me especially, was a way for my college to be paid for. And that was something that I really enjoyed. That was an aspect for me that was a benefit.
And thinking about going to West Point, did you have an idea in your head of which occupation, or I guess in Canada we call it trade, but did you know specifically what you wanted to do within the Army, or did you just know that you wanted to go to West Point?
So when I first started, I was hellbent on being an engineer. And it wasn't until I got to the academy that I switched gears. So we don't choose, we call it branches for the officers. I switched my idea of what I wanted to do my third year. So we choose our branches our third year. And I switched to military police. And the reason why was because at the time, women couldn't branch infantry. Now we've since opened up all branches to women. And at the time, they were calling military police the women's infantry. And I wanted that opportunity. I wanted the ability to really go to the women's infantry and to be able to prove myself as a female in that branch. And that was the closest that I could get to it. And on deployments, there were many women that were proving themselves in, especially Iraq at the time, in 2005, 2006, in that role. So that's why I wanted to go military police. So that's why I chose that role.
What does it look like to become trained then as a military police officer?
So military police at the time, so I commissioned in 2006, we went to what we call the basic officer leader course, which was at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. That course taught you how to be a platoon leader in the military police corps, which as a platoon leader, you had 42 troopers that were assigned to you. And then as a platoon leader, it was your job. These 42 soldiers were assigned to you. And that's your first job as a lieutenant, is to lead these soldiers. This is what you spent the last 4 years, whether at ROTC or at West Point, training to do, to lead these soldiers. And I think when we talk about going to, whether it's the academy or whether it's West Point, the pinnacle of your career is being a platoon leader. You are the first line of leadership, of officership. This is when a soldier graduates from basic training, the first officer that they will engage with and the first officer that they will meet when they arrive to their unit is going to be platoon leader. So it is a great responsibility and one that shouldn't be taken lightly. and it makes or breaks a career, and it's very important. And I think for me, it was very vital. I served my platoon leader time at Fort Cavazos in Texas, formerly Fort Hood, Texas. I had a great time there. I deployed to Iraq as a platoon leader, and I really enjoyed my time as a platoon leader. From there, I moved to a battalion S4 and served as a logistics officer in a military police battalion, which another great thing about officers is we're expected to be a mile wide and an inch deep on a multitude of topic areas. Not only are you expected to know your soldiers and to lead your soldiers, but you're also expected to know a lot of different things and to be able to brief, you know, the officers that are working alongside you and the officers that you work for. And that means that you need to know the details of the in and outs of those that you work with and the information of, you know, what's going on within your unit. So at that point, I was asked to know the logistics of that battalion, even though I wasn't a logistics officer. So it was a steep learning curve for me. And I, at that point, made a career change. I went to civil affairs, which a lot of people don't know was a small change in my career, but that's what got me to language training for Urdu, which is spoken in Pakistan. That got me to Fort Bragg. So I went through the civil affairs selection, successfully passed that, and then went to special operations language training here at Fort Bragg.
So you mentioned previously that the military police was sort of known as the women's infantry. From your experience there, what was the general attitude towards women? Or did you ever face any, you know, mistreatment in that sense? Or was it just sort of generally accepted that women are in the military police?
So I would say as a military police officer, women were accepted across the board. I would say that I was never treated differently as a woman in military police. I would say that women in military police were treated fairly as equals. And when I was a company commander as a military police officer, we were treated equally. And some of the best officers that I have ever worked with, especially in the military police corps, were women. And I think that when we look at officers, especially, and we look at skills that are required of officers, you have to be value added. You have to be good at your job. You have to know your job in and out, regardless of your gender, regardless of what you look like. And the bottom line, when you set foot into a position, you have to know what you're doing. You have to know what it is that you are walking into. You have to know what it is that is expected of you. And as long as you can do that, you will be successful.
For your deployment to Iraq, what was your role during that deployment? And then also, did you ever, you know, with the locals, did they have any issues with a woman?
So that first deployment to Iraq, I served as a platoon leader, and then I moved up to the brigade provost marshal. And as the brigade provost marshal, we had a really interesting dynamic. We were actually in charge of shutting down one of the detainee holding areas and moving those detainees, and they were moving to an Iraqi prison. So we actually worked with the Iraqi police quite a bit. And the Iraqi police were very easy to work with, and they didn't have a hard time working with me as a female at all, which was surprising to me because I anticipated them having a hard time working with a female, just because I had heard rumor that they would not receive me as a woman just culturally, but they didn't have any issues with me at all. So yeah, that was what I did for that first deployment.
What made you want to make that switch over to civil affairs? And did you get to choose which language you learned?
Yeah. So at that point in my career, I was trying to keep my family together, and I had taken a defense language aptitude exam and scored high on the exam. And that was the language that was given to me. So I chose to go to the civil affairs pipeline to get me to Fort Bragg. And I was assigned Urdu. While I was in language training, I found out that I was pregnant. I completed language training. And at the end of language training, you take what's called an oral proficiency interview. So I completed my oral proficiency interview in Urdu, and that just involves you sitting in a booth and you talk on the phone in your language with someone on the other line. So I'm talking to someone in Urdu and you complete the interview. And I remember completing the interview and you talk about all different things. You talk about the weather. You talk about news. They ask you about yourself. They ask you where you're from. They ask you to talk about, you know, what you've read recently. And I completed the interview. And I think at that point, I was probably, 4 or 5 months pregnant. And I completed the interview, and about a month and a half later, I remember saying to myself, I don't know if I can continue being in the Army and manage being a mom in the military. And I had this crisis of, oh my gosh, I don't know if I can do this. So about a month later, I remember walking into the NCO in charge of the course, and I withdrew from the civil affairs course. So at that moment, I withdrew, they send you back to your control branch, which was military police for me. So I withdrew from the civil affairs course after completing my language, and I went back to military police. And at this point, I'm a captain and I haven't had company command yet, and I'm on Fort Bragg. So I show up to the brigade on Fort Bragg, and I walk in and I see a former mentor of mine in the military police corps. And he says, hey, I thought you were going civil affairs. And I said, well, sir, you know, I finished language and obviously I'm pregnant. I don't know if I can do the Army thing anymore because I'm about to have a kid. And he said, you do realize that women do have children in the military and you're not the first woman that's had a child. You probably should try this out and figure out what it's like to balance being a mom and being in the military. And I said, I just don't think I can do it. So he sat me down and he said, I think you need to work out what it's like to balance military life and being a mom. And I think you have the capability, you're a good officer, you can do it. So that conversation and me deciding to withdraw from civil affairs really changed another moment of my trajectory of my career. And you have those moments in your career that really change your life. So I can pinpoint those moments. You know, I had that field trip to West Point. I have that moment where a mentor sat me down and said, you need to find that balance of motherhood and military career and finding that balance of what that looks like. And then there's a few more, but if it wasn't for that person saying to me, you're a good officer, don't give up, I don't know if I would be sitting here today having this conversation.
And then, so what were the next steps sort of after that? And after you had that realization, how did you proceed?
I was put into command after I had my son. And I figured it out. Obviously, my son is 11 years old. I had a successful company command. I think it's really important to understand before you have these moments in your life, you have to prioritize what's important to you as a person. You have to sit down with those that are important to you, whether that's your spouse, your significant other, your parents, your brothers, your sisters. You know, if you're a faithful person, pray about it. Whatever it is, you really do need to figure out what your priorities are and outline how you're going to balance those priorities while also figuring out how you're going to meet your goals. So for me at that point, I needed to figure out, okay, if I want to meet the next rank, how am I going to make that work while also being a mom? But also being a spouse while also maintaining my physical fitness. And I will say, jumping to present, one of the great things that the 82nd Airborne Division does that I have been able to experience is holistic health and fitness. They call it H2F. Here, the balance of spiritual, emotional, physical health, you know, they have nutritional coaches, they have physical coaches, they have, you know, PT specialists here for soldiers, no matter rank, no matter position, to go and reach out to so that you can go and get the assistance that you need. No matter what time of the day, you can go and see someone to go and get the help that you need so that you maintain that balance. And looking back in my career, there are moments that I wish that I had those opportunities that soldiers have now that can just keep you in that constant state of readiness. So I think as soldiers are looking for, how do I get myself ready for that next position as I'm prioritizing what I want to do? Those are the things that I would look for to make sure that I am ready.
That sounds really amazing, actually, that they have all of those resources there.
Yeah, it is truly remarkable.
So going from learning how to balance being a mom and having a career in the Army as well, what made you decide to do that switch from military police then to intelligence?
So I was coming out of company command and I was approached by a mentor on what I wanted to do next. And she said, hey, you've got a lot of really great interpersonal skills and you are really good at talking to people. And what is it that you want to do in your career? What are some of your career aspirations? And I said, honestly, I haven't really thought of what I want to do next. I was really taking it one day at a time. And she said, hey, have you thought about switching into a specialized field of intelligence? And I said, I hadn't really thought about it. So I was interviewed for a human intelligence opportunity, and I had to go through some interviews, and I went through the interview process, and I went through some evaluations and had to go through some training, and I went through and successfully assessed for all of it. And once I was through that and went through the training, I moved up to DC and was assigned up there for several years. And you are then assigned to intelligence, but I had never been through intelligence training. So I went from military police to now I am assigned as an intelligence officer, but you're a human intelligence officer. So I was a human intelligence officer in DC, and I was working with these former, you know, intelligence officers who had been doing intelligence work their entire career. So I had a very steep learning curve and I really enjoyed it. I was always up for a challenge. I loved the impact that I was making because I could see that my work that I was doing was changing some of the things that we were doing, whether it was political or strategic, or whether it was what we were doing for our goals in our command or what our unit was doing. And I really enjoyed that aspect of it. So I worked in DC for a little while, and I even got to use some of my language skills, which I didn't think would ever come in handy because I did that training for civil affairs and I withdrew from that course. And for me, as, you know, taking Urdu, I thought, when am I ever going to meet, you know, a Pakistani in an operational role other than going to Pakistan? But I had the opportunity to talk to an individual from Pakistan. And I remember having this individual who sat across from me. And everyone had said, he's really difficult to work with. No one wants to work with him. He won't talk to you. He won't talk to you, especially because you're a woman. And I remember sitting down and simply saying to him, "Aap kaise hain?" which is, how are you? And he turned his head a little and looked at me again. And he said to me in English, what did you just say? And I said again, Ab kese hain. And then I said, Meta nam Marissa hey. And he said, you speak Urdu? And I said, a little, I know a little Urdu. And I hadn't spoken Urdu in years. And he was very taken aback at the fact that I had even attempted to speak broken Urdu to him. And from that moment on, every time I saw him, he would do whatever we would ask him. And it's moments like that where anytime, whether it's intelligence work, whether you're a leader in the military, whether you're in corporate America, if you're asking someone to do something for you, you have to establish rapport. You have to establish a relationship with that person, and you have to be an empathetic leader. You have to care. And it's things like being able to speak the same language and being able to have enough understanding of who they are, understanding their language. And in that moment, I knew that he just wanted someone to at least attempt to speak his language, that it broke the ice. And I was able to break that barrier that had been there for so many years, that he then wanted to be in the same room as us. And anything that we asked him to do in the future, he would want to do with us. So that was just one of those moments where, okay, I can use this to our benefit in the future. So that was just one of those cool moments that I like to share.
Yeah. I mean, even if you can't speak a language fluently, like making that little effort to know a little bit or to be able to introduce yourself, it goes such a long way. I can remember we had just a little static display. We had a Korean general visiting our unit. And I've sort of, you know, ever since I went to Korea, I've been really interested in sort of learning the language and watching some K-dramas. And he walked into the room and I just like introduced myself in Korean and his eyes just got as wide as saucers. And immediately it was just like, oh my God, this is amazing. Even though that's kind of all I knew. But just like you said, it builds that rapport and it definitely helps those relationships.
Absolutely. And in the Army, we have soldiers from all over the world who joined the U.S. Army. And you don't know how much it would mean to them if you just say hello to them in their language and how much it would make them feel like part of the family by simply saying, how are you, in their language. And it's as simple as that. And it takes how long to even learn a simple sentence? Like, you watched how many K-dramas to learn hello in that language? It's as simple as that. And for Urdu, you can watch. So Hindi and Urdu in spoken form sound very similar. So when I was learning Urdu, I would watch Bollywood movies on the weekends to get some of the spoken form of Urdu. And sometimes, you know, when I'm trying to pretend like I'm going to learn Urdu again, I'll watch Bollywood movies just to get back into it. But that's how I would practice on the weekends, would just be to watch Bollywood movies. So.
And did I also read that you know Spanish and French as well?
So I was a double language major at West Point. I took Spanish in high school. And then when I went to West Point, I was a Spanish major and I took French as well. And I got to spend a semester abroad at the Spanish Military Academy. So the first exchange program that we did with the Spanish Military Academy, I got to do, me and two other cadets, we got to go to the Spanish Military Academy. And we had to take my first French class I took while I was at the Spanish Military Academy. So not only was I a Spanish major, but I was also learning my first French class while in Spain. So in another target language. So yes, I was a Spanish and French major at the academy.
I find it so interesting, people that can speak multiple languages. And I sometimes get in a YouTube wormhole where I see these people that speak 5+ languages. And for Europeans, it's really common for them to be really fluent in so many languages. So, I mean, do you have any specific tips or tricks, or how did you manage to learn all of these different languages?
So for me, what worked is music. Music worked for me. I was able to listen to Spanish music and find the lyrics in the translated language to refer back to. The other thing, immersion, living in the country forced me to have to speak in that target language. I did Chilean Mountain Warfare School. So I spent 4 weeks down in Portillo, Chile, and I had to speak the language. Otherwise, I wouldn't have survived. So I had to learn how to speak Spanish down there, obviously, in Chile. And then in Spain, when I was at the Spanish Military Academy, immersion forces you to have to speak in the language. Now, you could go and immerse yourself and spend all of the time in your hotel room and never speak in the language, or, you know, not utilize the language and only speak English or use, you know, Google Translate. But if you go to a foreign country and force yourself to learn the language, or even just attempt to speak in the language, the broken version of the language will teach you more just by trying. There's a ton of apps out there. I used Rosetta Stone when I was in college. I think folks used Babelfish was another one that people use. Duolingo, I know some folks use that as well. Even just a few minutes a day. Learning languages also keeps your part of your brain activated that helps your brain maintain, I forget what it's called, but it keeps your brain young, and it's helpful and it's very important. And I think we just don't use it as much as we should. I find it very fascinating. I think linguistics is very interesting. I just really enjoy it.
I mentioned this on another podcast, but I had heard, I think it was Tim Ferriss talking about learning languages and saying that, you know, that's sort of the best way to retain your brain cells and keep your brain sharp is to learn new languages. And for myself, like in Canada, we usually go to, you can do either French immersion, but if you go to school in mainly English, you'll still at least get some French language training. But I was in French immersion all growing up, so I still can read and understand French, but speaking it is so rusty. And I'm always so nervous to say something because I don't want to sound ridiculous. But now I've just kind of gotten over that. And I'm like, the only way that I'm going to become more fluent is to just get over that fear of sounding silly and just start attempting to speak it.
Absolutely. We have a few exchange officers here in the 82nd Airborne Division. And in fact, yesterday I was walking up the stairs and my husband had informed the Chilean exchange officer that I speak Spanish. So I'm walking up the stairs and he says, in the middle of, we have this very large hallway, he yells down the hallway in Spanish, "I hear that you speak Spanish, Marissa." And of course, now I have to speak Spanish in front of all of these people. So we start speaking Spanish and it forces me to have to speak the language. And that is honestly the best way. And I get embarrassed that I'm saying things wrong, but by doing it, you retain more. So you have to force yourself to do it. And the more you do it, the better you get. Just like anything, it becomes routine.
So going back, I'm not going to let this slip by. You said you went to Chilean Mountain Warfare School. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So West Point does a great job of providing cadets with opportunities to go to, we called them, I believe they were called AIADs. I forget what the acronym stands for, so I won't even attempt to tell you what it is. I don't know if they do them anymore, and I'm dating myself. However, they were opportunities for cadets to go to training over in other countries in a target language. So for me, because I was a Spanish major, I went to Chile and I went to this course at the Chilean Mountain Warfare School with Chilean cadets. And it was during the summer because it was in the Southern Hemisphere. So it was obviously their winter, our summer. And what they taught you to do is how to survive in winter conditions. So you flew into Santiago de Chile and you started out in their academy, and then you moved to Portillo in the Andes and you built snow caves and you stayed in a snow cave for 3 days and you randonnée skied to the top of a mountain and then you skied down. It was beautiful, extremely cold and miserable, but I learned a lot about myself that I don't ever want to get stuck in the snow and have to build a snow cave. But if I needed to, I would be okay. They have a much longer course, which is for their enlisted and officer population, which they get a badge for, much like our equivalent of a ranger school. But their cadets go through an abbreviated version, which is what we got to go through. We also got to ski in Portillo in their civilian Andes Mountains for one whole day. And it was remarkable, some of the best skiing that I've ever had. And it was beautiful. I have some pictures from it. I can send them to you so you can post them, but it was really, really pretty.
Awesome. I mean, it sounds like you've done lots of really amazing things during your career and you've had all these great experiences. But have you ever had any moments throughout your career where you thought, this is way too difficult, I don't want to do this, and sort of maybe questioned your decisions on whether or not you want to continue?
I have had a couple of moments like that. I think I can remember my last deployment to Syria. I can remember writing an email to someone and saying, I don't think I want to do this anymore. I was a human support troop team leader, and I was the only woman on the team, and I was supporting a special operations team out there. And my job was to basically go out and gather intelligence on where the enemy was located. So as a woman that was out there, I had to go and establish rapport, not just with the women that were in the local community, but with the men as well. So the linguist that was with me, we would go out to the area that we were located, and we would basically try and communicate with them to establish rapport and establish a relationship with them and get them to want to talk to us. And that required us to get my face out there. We had to let them know who I was. And I was the only woman there for a while. And because of that, I was becoming a known quantity. And as I became a known quantity, we started to get reports back that the enemy was starting to know where I was, which then put me at risk and then put my team at risk. And what we were realizing is that the enemy was using that to their advantage. They were starting to realize where we were going and what we were doing. And I didn't want to put them at risk, but I also wanted to do my job. So I didn't want to be a risk to them. I didn't want to be a burden to them, but I also wanted to do my job. And it was one of those moments where I really had this question of, am I doing my job the right way? And am I providing what I need to provide to this team? Am I providing what I need to provide to the organization? Am I providing the intelligence that they need to get the job done? Or am I being a liability? And as I really peeled back the information, I was providing them what they needed. And we all were assuming a risk by being there. And it was all the same risk, right? But it was really that questioning of, okay, what is the risk? And is me being here creating an additional risk or not? And it wasn't. It was just me really adding an additional question of, and I think we all have that moment of, what am I questioning? How am I adding value? And as long as a leader, and I think we all go through that moment where we're all, especially as good leaders, we all have to evaluate what we're doing and how we're doing it and what is it that we want to bring to the table. And then going back to what we talked about earlier, is this aligning to the priorities of my life? Is this aligning to the priorities of what I want in the future? And if it's not, then maybe it's time to hang up the uniform and find what's next for me. I will say that there were moments in that deployment where I struggled with some of the things that were going on around me that I really had to rely on the team to help me through. And I think camaraderie is really important. I think mental health is really important. And those are things that we don't often talk about, but need to be talked about and are really important, that need to be at the forefront of what we do as leaders, and especially as senior leaders, and especially whether male or female, we need to make sure that we discuss, especially as organizational leaders too.
And so during that deployment, if you did have like a particularly difficult day where you were struggling, what would you do in terms of coping mechanisms or to, say, decompress at the end of a difficult day?
For me, I think journaling is really important. I think writing stuff down works for me. Because I was the only woman, it was hard for me to talk through some of those things. I didn't want to talk through too much of what I was feeling because I didn't want to be a burden to the rest of the team. I think I wrote down a lot of what I was feeling and journaled. I had a great support network back home that I could share what I was going through with what I could share. I have a great tribe. I've got a great support network. And I think that's really important. And I think you need that no matter where you go, whether you're in the Army, whether you're not in the Army, family, friends, your tribe is really important. And that helps you through those difficult times. Working out is really important for me. That's one of the best coping mechanisms, whether it's going for a run, whether it's yoga, whether it's just unwinding at the end of the day or starting out your day, whatever it is for you, whatever your healthy coping mechanism is. Going back to, we talked about H2F earlier, you have to find that healthy balance for your spiritual, emotional, physical well-being. You have to make sure that you have that healthy balance, because there's going to be those days where you're going to be stressed to the max. And if you don't have that healthy balance and you can't get back to it, you're going to feel off for a period of days. And I think the other thing that's worked for me, I have those trusted confidants that can notice in me when I'm a little bit off. And I have those trusted confidants where I can tell them, hey, if you notice this in me, I need you to tell me. If you notice that I am not eating, or if you notice that I am being a little bit snippy, or if you notice that I'm not showing up on time to meetings, whatever it is, I have those individuals who can recognize signs and symptoms in me that maybe are ways that exhibit stressors, so that they can help me cope with things. And I think you have to have that no matter where you are, whether you're working in the military or you're not in the military, you have to have that tribe that's with you that helps you cope with things. And as leaders, sometimes we don't want to admit that we need that assistance, but you do, whether you're a leader at a very senior level or a leader at a very junior level, you need to have that tribe of people that are helping alongside you to make you successful.
Yeah, one of my previous guests, Liz McConaughey, she was a Royal Air Force Chinook crewman. She mentioned in her book, you know, we've got to get out of this automatic response when someone asks, how are you doing? Saying, oh, I'm good. Even if you're not, we're so conditioned to just say that. She mentioned in her book, maybe implementing like, oh, well, you know what, today I'm a 6 out of 10, like not doing so well, or just telling someone instead of this automatic, like, yeah, I'm fine, everything's fine. Like you said, it's so good to have those people that you can talk to, or tell them like, yes, tell me if you're noticing that something is off.
Right. Or just let's start having honest conversations about how you're truly feeling. Even maybe not what the honest thing that is going on in your life, because I don't necessarily think that every single person needs to know what is going on in your life, because there are some people that shouldn't know. But you can say, hey, I'm not feeling 100% today. Or, hey, you know, I'm a 6 out of 10 today. that's okay. You can say that, but there has to be at least one person in your life who truly knows you as a person. And if there's not, then that to me is an issue. You have got to have at least one person in your life that knows you. You have got to have someone in your life that you can rely on to help you through those hard times. And I think that's where we as leaders need to ensure that every single one of our soldiers has somebody that they can rely on, whether it's family, whether it's friends, whether it's another soldier in their organization, whether it's a leader. We owe that to our soldiers. We owe that to our friends and our family, our veterans. We have to make sure that we have at least somebody that we can rely on that knows us through and through.
Very solid points. And now I'm looking at obviously the big Airborne logo on your sleeve and right behind you. And I know that one of your previous roles was the executive officer of the Golden Knights. And you also have a bunch of military jump qualifications. So talk to me about when you started jumping out of airplanes.
Yes. So I actually started a little bit later in my career. So I went to airborne school in 2010 as a captain, and then I commanded the 21st MP Company Airborne here at Fort Bragg. And then went to Jump Master School because it was imperative as a company commander that I was capable of performing the Jump Master inspection on all of my paratroopers before they jumped out of an airplane. So I have been on Fort Bragg since then, continued to jump out of perfectly good airplanes since then. And I then continued that progression. I was afforded the opportunity to interview to work for the Golden Knights in the end of 2017, so the beginning of 2018. So I was the battalion executive officer for the Golden Knights. Prior to that, I had not done any free fall jumping. So little known fact for the Golden Knights, for the officer side of the house, you do not have to be free fall qualified. You do not have to have any experience for any civilian skydiving for the Golden Knights, for the officers. So when you get to the team for the officers, they will teach you how to skydive. And the reason why they do that is they want you to understand what it's like to skydive so you can understand how to best support them in your role, whatever role you serve as an officer on the team. So as the executive officer, my role was to manage the budget, resource the team, make sure that they had all of the support for personnel, make sure I managed the staff. So I was the chief of staff. I was the support role for the commander. And I served in that position for a period of 3 years. And I learned how to skydive while I was there. And it was remarkable. I got to travel all over the world with the team. And they are experts in the field. I mean, they are world-class athletes. They are Olympic skydivers. They are the most humble human beings. They will never tell you that they are world-class gold medalists in any of the events that they are in skydiving. And it was just so cool to be a part of the team. So they taught me how to skydive. I loved it. I wish I could have jumped way more than I did, but because I was making sure that they could jump and do all of the backside support, I didn't get to jump as much as I wanted to, but I had a blast on the team. And I was the first female executive officer on the team. They had never had a female executive officer on the team before. And I got to travel to Australia and watch the team win in Australia and meet a ton of celebrities on the team. And we supported the U.S. Army Recruiting Command, which was a very interesting mission. Mm-hmm. And we messaged the importance of joining the Army. So we are broken down in the United States Army in different types of command. So the U.S. Army Recruiting Command is responsible for trying to get recruits into the Army. And the Golden Knights travels all over the United States and jumps into key events like demonstrations at air shows and NASCAR events or baseball stadiums. And after those events, we'll go and interact with the local public and talk to high school students, college students, and engage with them to talk about the opportunities that the United States Army has to offer and let them know that the Army will pay for college, will pay for tuition, will offer them incentives on joining the military, and talk to them about some of the incentives that are out there. And it was really interesting to hear some of the talent that these young individuals have and some of the things that they're interested in, and talk to parents about some of the concerns that they have and why or why not in regards to their children wanting to join the military. And I really enjoyed that piece of it, because as a human intelligence officer and talking to sources or talking to people in general, and then using some of those skill sets and then talking to parents and kids and talking about the Army, it was just one of those moments where it's very interesting to see how different skill sets sort of carry over.
I follow the Golden Knights on Instagram, and I've seen, I mean, we have the Skyhawks in Canada, but I don't think they do some, you know, they do the demonstration side, but not so much the competition side. But it's so impressive when you see the videos of some of those stadium jumps. And then I think I also saw one where they landed on an aircraft carrier. And now I think they're even starting like base jumping as well, which is insanely impressive. So, I mean, throughout your military career, like, what do you enjoy the most about it?
Oh my gosh, that is, I don't even think I can put into words what I enjoy the most. Let's see. I love the fact that I get to be with soldiers and I get to hear all of their stories of why they serve. And there are so many reasons why soldiers come into the Army. And it's really interesting to hear how they chose why they're here and what they're doing. And I love that. I love the fact that I have the privilege to serve alongside so many talented individuals, and I get to call them, you know, my counterparts. And I am really lucky that I've had such a long career and I've had these great opportunities that I never thought that I would have had. I am telling you that if you would have asked some of my classmates if I would have been here nearly 17 years later, they would laugh at you, because I told everyone that I was going to do my 5 years and get out. I have had such a great career and I've had such an interesting career, and it was nothing like what the Army doctrinally would have laid out, but I have enjoyed it. And I think that the mentorship aspect of it, I love the opportunity to mentor the junior officers and seeing them grow and being able to impart some of the wisdom that I wish I would have had someone say to me, no, don't do that. Or that part of the lessons that I've learned that I can help them grow and get better sooner. I really enjoy that aspect of it. The fact that I was able to stay in after I had my son and be able to show a young officer that you're capable of being a mom and finding balance and being able to manage a career and be somewhat successful. I think those are all great aspects of service that I hope that I can demonstrate to some young officer or future officer who wants to serve.
And so what are your goals for the future career-wise and on the personal side?
So I am hoping to be a battalion commander. The Army does what's called the Battalion Commander Assessment Program. It's called BCAP, and I am hoping to conduct that in the fall. And then I would take battalion command the following year. And then we'll see what happens after that. So that would be professional. Personal, I am running another marathon in November. And then personal, another personal is just following my son around and soccer. He is a big soccer player. So we are constantly just attending all of his soccer games and watching him play. He is moving up from 9v9 to 11v11. So that'll be a big change for him next year.
I know he's still young, but has he shown any interest in potentially joining the military when he grows up?
So he has. His dad and stepmother and his stepdad are all military. So he is predisposed to the military, and he ebbs and flows on whether he'll go to the military academy or just enlist. And we all tell him, just go with whatever you want to do and we'll support you. So we'll see what he wants to do. We're all just saying, follow your own dreams and do whatever you want. But I think the military is just in his blood.
That's great that you guys are so supportive of doing what he wants to do rather than like, you have to go to West Point because that's the family tradition or, you know, something along those lines. And now, so my final question that I always ask everyone is, what advice would you give to women looking to join the military?
I think the biggest piece of advice that I would give, and it would be just prepare yourself physically, mentally, emotionally. Going back to what I stated earlier, you want to make sure that you understand what your role is, whatever role that you want to fulfill. You want to know what your job is going to be. You want to prioritize what your personal goals are going to be, what your professional goals are going to be. You want to make sure that you're ready. You're ready physically. You're ready mentally. There are tons of ways to get yourself ready. There's tons of resources out there. I know, Kate, you're really big on sharing some of those resources through your page. I would continue to find some of those resources on your page. There's tons out there on the internet. For me, I think finding your tribe, your support network is really important. Make sure you have those folks that are in your corner that are helping you to get yourself ready for whatever it is. Have those folks that are in your corner supporting you. And then find a good mentor that's going to be there to reach out to you, to support you on your journey, to ask questions when things get a little bit difficult, and that when things are going your way, to help you along your journey as you continue in your career.
Amazing advice. And thank you so much for your time today. I apologize for the little hiccups that we had at the beginning, but I mean, I want to be respectful of your time, but I feel like I could talk to you for hours because you've just had this super interesting career. And as I'm writing up the description of your picture, I'm like, this sounds like a Dos Equis ad, you know, like this most interesting woman in the world, because you've done so much really neat stuff. And I think it just really highlights the opportunities that are out there when you look for them and when you work for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things, and I tell this to a lot of the folks that I mentor, one of the things that I will always tell folks is that opportunities exist no matter where you look. You just have to look for them. They may not result in the career that you wanted, but you will always look back and say, I had a great career. And that is what I can say. I have had a great career and I have enjoyed my career, and I have a lot of really great stories that I can tell. And I will never look back on my career and say I can regret anything.
Thank you for listening. The biggest way to help support this podcast is to leave a rating and review on your Apple Podcasts and Spotify apps. You can also visit my Instagram page at Shoot Like a Girl Podcast to see photos from the guests, keep up to date with the podcast, and find out about any merchandise releases.